Welcome in to the latest R. Bill Simmons podcast. I am Tribe, your host. And today we're breaking down the major sports media topics over the last couple of weeks. A lot of stuff going on in this space. We're going to talk ESPN charter dispute, why the deal got resolved, what it means for the NBA going forward, why Mina Kimes makes a lot more sense at ESPN over Spotify, the Wall Street Journal article about Spotify from a week ago saying they've made a $1 billion bet on podcasting and it hasn't really worked out. The article mentions Bill Simmons. We'll speculate on his future there as well. So we're going to get into all of that. But first, if you've not checked out the previous episode, I highly recommend doing so. We had a guest on, CJ. He's a little bit younger than Bill. He's been a Bill fan for 20 years. So he was able to combat some of Bill's pop culture takes from the 80s, from the 90s. Has a new name for the Ewing theory, a lot of fun. And then certainly if you're an NFL fan and you didn't check out the gambling preview of the 2023 NFL season, taking down Bill's 2023 NFL takes, that's a fun one as well. So let's do this. We're going to start with the ESPN deal. Now, Bill's been talking about this a lot on his podcast, Ben Thompson, Nick Khan. So this is a huge story. It has wide-ranging implications for just about every single sport, but in particular the NBA. And the question is, why was this deal hold up in the first place? And ultimately, Charter, 15 million video subscribers. I think they're number two in the US, so they hold a lot of power. And usually these contracts, they run 3 or 4 years. Typically, there's price increases annually, and the video distributor continues to pay the price increases. Charter this time around said, wait a second, I don't want to pay as much as Disney wants. We're paying Disney $2.2 billion a year, and we don't feel like we're getting enough value out of it. So this is an issue, and we're willing to drop all of the Disney channels, including ESPN. And so if that did happen, if ESPN was dropped, just to briefly touch on that, ESPN is a part of Disney's linear TV business network. That runs about $8 to $10 billion of income. Of earnings every single year. And so ESPN, if they're being paid $2.2 billion by, or Disney, if they're being paid $2.2 billion by Charter, that's immediately a 25% cut to earnings. That's huge. Charter knows they have that leverage, and Disney simply cannot afford Charter to end up not paying them. So Disney knows that. On the other hand, Charter, they're in a negotiation. Charter spends about $17 billion, or Charter spends $11 billion on programming costs for the radio business a year, but they make $17 billion in video revenue. And video also helps their broadband business. It keeps people in the mix. If Charter bundles video with broadband, with wireless they're doing now, it's pretty hard for somebody to churn from that, right? Because they're getting so many products from Charter. It's going to be a huge deal to end up going out there and switching providers. So Charter benefits from video, but Charter in this negotiation is saying, we want to get more. If we're going to pay you what you want in terms of Disney, we want to get more. And so the key element of this negotiation and what it ended up is Charter dropped stupid third-tier channels that almost nobody watches, Freeform, FXX, Disney Junior. They dropped those third-tier channels. And people are might going like, what even are these channels? Nat Geo Wild was another one. So let's zoom back to 10 years ago. Why were these channels in there? Because one of the ways, when the bundle was increasing, right? The bundle went from zero subs to 100 million subs. These are people that subscribe to a big linear TV package. That is now 75 million. But as it was growing from zero to 100, one of the ways companies like Disney generated more money is they would launch new channels and then they'd get paid for the channels and get paid for the advertising. So certainly Disney, and prior to the ownership of FX, FX was owned by Fox, but Disney did this and they said, hey, we have all this content for Disney Channel. Let's make Disney Junior and we can start getting paid in Disney Junior. Same thing with Fox and FXX. Hey, we have FX. Why don't we launch FXX and we can get even more money? So that was done. But nowadays, nobody's watching that. And Charter can see the internal data. They know nobody's watching it. So Charter said, you know what? If you want your consistent ESPN increases, let's drop. I don't want these channels anymore. I don't want these third tier channels. And Disney wasn't happy with that because they would lose a lot of money for those third tier channels. They still got paid for them. And so what the key swap was that basically in exchange for Disney allowing Charter to drop these third tier channels that nobody's watching, Charter is now paying a wholesale rate to Disney to distribute Disney Plus to their with ads to their most to their basic video provider to their basic video package that has probably at least 12 million of their 15 million subscribers. So in Charter's perspective, they're going, I'm paying about the same rate, and John Orand at the Sports Business Journal pretty much said this, that it's a pretty similar dollar amount. We don't know exactly, but Charter is dropping these crap 13 channels that nobody watches, but instead they're getting Disney Plus with ads for their video subscribers. And to me, that's a great swap because nobody was watching those 13 channels, but a lot of people would watch Disney Plus. So you might have, I think about the average 60-year-old boomer. Bill talked about this in his pod that has a video bundle from Charter. They might not have Disney Plus. They might not have an interest in watching Disney Plus, but now that Disney Plus is going to be included with Charter video package, they might take a crack at watching Mandalorian. They might take a crack at some Marvel movie. So that's the benefit that Disney's getting, and Disney's now getting paid for providing Disney Plus. So that was the swap. And then John Orand at SBJ also reported that ESPN gets their classic 7-8% annual rate increase. So, okay, so you hear that and you go, ESPN's getting 7-8% annually in rate increases. Great business. Why can't they afford to pay a bunch more money for the NBA? Well, we also have to go back again to the last time Disney signed an NBA deal. And that was in 2015. That was when the bundle had reached its peak. It had reached 100 million subscribers and it was staying there. And so, if ESPN at that point, they were getting the 7 to 8 annual increases, price increases for the channel, and executives were going, okay, if I'm getting 8% revenue annually for Disney, for ESPN, I can afford to pay the NBA another 7 to 8% annually a year. Or typically it's a little bit less than that, but the next contract steps up. Because the ESPN business model, simplistically, I think I saw something like they were spending $7 billion on programming expense. So the ESPN Disney the business model is that you make more revenue through distribution revenue, which is every single subscriber in the linear video package. If you have a bundle, you probably pay $10 a month on average to as part of ESPN. And then ESPN gets all that revenue, and then they get the distribution revenue. So that's how they're making most of their money. They're also making some money on advertising. And Disney makes more money combining distribution revenue and advertising than they do on programming costs. So they're the middleman, right? And unfortunately, with businesses like the middleman, a lot of times they get cut out eventually, or at least their margin decreases, which is happening with ESPN lately. But ESPN revenue has pretty much been flat recently. And why is that? Well, it's because those 7 to 8% annual increases are being offset by 7 to 8% annual declines in subscribers. Will 7 to 8% go higher than that? Could be. It's gone from 0% a few years ago to 7-8% now. And so what Disney has to be careful of, and this doesn't go for Disney, but this goes for everybody in the video ecosystem. If you sign a long-term deal with the NBA or any sports league for that matter, and you are okay with paying them significant increases, well, your revenue might start shrinking. And that's how ultimately businesses fail. The reason that the business is going to go bankrupt is because they have fixed costs that either are similar or go up. And then they have revenue declining. So when you have those two things together, your earnings are in free fall and you go bankrupt. This is what happened with Diamond Sports, the big owner of regional sports networks. Their revenue, due to cord cutting and also due to a lot of video distributors actually dropped the regional sports networks, their revenue went down like crazy, but they still had the sports rights contracts. So they were paying 3, 4, 5% annual increases to show all the regional sports games. And so when you had that revenue down, sports costs go up. They had no way of cutting costs. Earnings went from, I think it was $1.5 billion to almost nothing now. They had too much debt. They went bankrupt. So look, if the deal didn't happen, it would have been dreadful for everybody in the video ecosystem. All the main stocks dropped like crazy on the news that there's a dispute. They rebounded when the dispute was resolved. So we avoided that. But ultimately, in what Ben Thompson said on Bill's podcast last Friday, this isn't the best timing for the NBA to do a deal when the video ecosystem is in such potential peril. And what the NBA needs to figure out is where are we going to show our games? And then this speaks to the Nick Khan point, where Nick Khan says, right now there's two video providers for the NBA. There's ESPN, there's Warner Brothers Discovery. I don't think and this is paraphrasing Nick Khan, I don't think the NBA can get the rights increases they want if they only have two partners showing their games. They might need four, they might need six. He even said that in the podcast. So what it probably looks like is if you eliminated streaming completely, right? Let's say let's for the purpose of the argument, let's say streaming is eliminated. I don't think the NBA would get that much more for their next rights deal than the current one. The finals are extremely valuable still, as are the playoffs. The regular season NBA games, I know a lot of people don't watch as much as before, and a lot of people think they're meaningless, but they still get decent ratings. They can get 2 million a night, 1 to 2 million, 1 to 3 million. They get good demo. So it's not like they should go for nothing, but there's not as much money in that ecosystem. Like I said, ESPN used to make 8-10% annual revenue gains. ESPN is now flat revenue at best and probably declining in the future as cord cutting increases. So there's really no chance they can afford to pay up significantly for the NBA. In reality, what they would do is they would pay up for the NBA and they maybe drop some other sports, but there's still a limit on how much they can pay up for the NBA. So that's the linear ecosystem is in decline. However, streaming is a growth business. Now, it's less growthy than it has been recently because all these companies are focused on getting back to profitability in their streaming business. But the good thing about sports is that it's instant customer acquisition. Yes, it might be expensive, but if you are an NBA fan, you are going to subscribe to the streaming service to watch NBA. And the idea and how that works is once you're in that streaming service, you don't only watch the NBA, you start watching other shows. So Amazon paying $1 billion for Thursday Night Football, it's significantly more than was being paid previously. I still think it looks like an overpay, but the idea is that Amazon Prime, okay, I'm in there. Now let's see what other shows they have. So they're benefiting the other shows. Amazon Prime is as well. What else can I buy on there when you're in that ecosystem? But think about Peacock. Nick Khan talked about this as well. And Mark Shapiro talked about this on Matt Belloni's The Town podcast. Peacock with the WWE has a hardcore fan base. Everybody who's a WWE fan has to subscribe to Peacock. They're probably not only watching WWE, they watch other stuff, so it benefits them that way. It's the same thing with this playoff game coming up. Peacock has an exclusive playoff game. They're going to be given the worst one for sure with the NFL. But what's going to happen is everybody signs up for Peacock, and then once you have the subscription, oh, yeah, hey, I haven't watched The Office in 3 years. Where's The Office been? It's now on Peacock instead of Netflix? Okay. I'll start watching The Office. Oh, let me check out Poker Face, this new original. Oh, that was pretty good. Nice. I'm now pumped for season two when it comes out. So it's all about spending now, and it's basically marketing dollars and it's instant customer acquisition dollars to get people on your streamer. So that's why there is going to be a streaming bid, in my opinion, for the NBA, in addition to linear video. So the NBA's got two kind of ways it can straddle the lines of this deal. You give some to ESPN and Warner Brothers Discovery as a way for them to continue having solid content on their networks, but you're not going to get a ton from it. You give some to Amazon and to Apple because you want to get more money, and it's a great way for their streaming services to grow. So you get more money there. And then I think NBC is the one that really straddles the line here. I really like what NBC might do here, because NBC has shown they're aggressive with the NFL in terms of putting it on Peacock. They're doing the same thing with Big Ten. They're putting it on both NBC and Peacock, and they're doing the Sunday Night Football on Peacock. So what I would expect NBC to do is they could get into a deal with the NBA where they have it on big NBC broadcasts. And they also have it on Peacock. And so the NBA benefits because they make a lot of money from the deal. And their games are on broadcast, where broadcast is available to all 130 million homes in the US. Now, for all intents and purposes, not 130 million people have access to it. But if desired, you can get an antenna and watch broadcast TV. That compares to the 75 million cable homes, which are declining. So the NBA has talked about this as well. They want more reach for their games. So NBC provides reach. And then in terms of what NBC's getting, they're getting a great sports package for their broadcast network. Great. And they're also getting an instant customer acquisition for Peacock for people who don't subscribe to the linear TV bundle. They don't have an antenna. They'll pop on to Peacock to watch NBA. And again, like I said before, they'll watch the other stuff. So that's why I think you could see a lot of people involved here. I agree with Nick Khan. You get your original two people, you get your original Disney, and you get your original Disney and original Warner Bros. Disca. You bring in either Amazon or Apple, or maybe both. And then I think you get NBC at a pretty nice deal. And when you combine all of those together, yes, the NBA contract is looking like it's going to be bigger by a decent margin than the previous deal. Now, what was the reason why Ben Thompson was negative on the NBA doing a deal? I think Ben rightly is concerned about the linear TV media ecosystem. When I say that, it's the bundle. He is rightly concerned about that in decline. So, where he could be right there is if the streaming services actually say, you know what, I don't really want much NBA, or I don't want to pay that much for it. If NBC decides, yeah, that's a big expenditure for us. If Warner Bros. Disca says, maybe we'll just get out of the NBA in general. That's sort of where they might face issues. But I think right now, yes, maybe they don't get three times the previous deal, but with such a premium tier product that the NBA is, and with everyone swirling around looking to improve streaming and then looking to continue their linear video business, I think that's okay. One final point here. So, what's happened with this Charter deal, them dropping FXX, Disney Junior, Freeform, Baby Disney, Nat Geo Wild, is they do that. Essentially, what it means is that in that legacy TV bundle that the people subscribe to, there's now less money being going to those channels. Because if you're on Charter, you're not paying for that. So that actually frees up more money to go to sports. So in essence, what ESPN is going to be looking to do is they're going to be saying, you know, not that I want to pay a huge increase, but now I'm getting paid. The ESPN is a higher percentage of my earnings right now after that Charter deal. So I need to protect that business and I need to feed that business. So you feed that through keeping the NBA, but you make sure you don't pay too aggressively because you know the cable subscribers are declining in the future. So that's basically what's going on. Hopefully that was helpful. And then I think that transitions to the Mita Kimes piece, to borrow Bill phrase. So a lot of people on R. Bill Simmons, a lot of people on Twitter that I've been interacting with, I've just seen it. A lot of people say Mita Kimes should be at the Ringer. It would be great to have her there. Why isn't she there? And I've always argued, and a lot of people have too, that she's not a natural fit there because you got to talk about revenue generation. So Bill Simmons, massive revenue generator. This guy's podcast, I don't know how much his podcast makes, but it's in the several million range. It has to be. Absolutely has to be. And he does that because of ads. But Who is on Bill's level in the sports game? Part of my take, Russillo is up there. Maybe Lebatard's up there. Not that many people are up there. Mina Kimes is not up there from a podcast perspective, and she's not known for podcasting. So for the Ringer to go and hire her, to pay her what she wants and to what she got at ESPN, which was almost $2 million a year, to get to that level, what you really need is at least $2 million of revenue generation to the Ringer for that contract. And I don't see Mina getting there, both in terms of podcasting or if she started doing video for the Ringer, because if you look at the Ringer's video page on YouTube, they don't really get that many views. So they're not making that much money from video. Why was she worth $2 million a year to ESPN, though? And so the reason for that is, so I talked about ESPN spending a lot of money on sports rights. They spend even more money on the NFL than the NBA. And the reason for that is NFL's king. NFL gets, I think they got 22 million for Monday Night Football. NBA Finals get 12 million. And the average NFL, the average NBA regular season game gets, call it, like I said, 2 million. So very different between the two sports. So ESPN has a vested interest in keeping the NFL happy, and they have a budget in addition to the sports rights to create a good NFL product. This is why they have Troy and Joe on the call, much improved from previous years. And everybody said, hey, I love having a great booth. Why are they paying for the Manning cast? They're probably getting extra viewership from that. So ESPN has a vested interest in making the NFL and their network great. And they do this on NFL Live. It's one of their premier daily shows. Mina Kimes is on NFL Live. So even if I took the advertising aspect out of NFL Live, ESPN needs to be paying their analysts money to be on that show to have a good NFL product to promote the NFL. And ESPN's also paying for NFL highlights. Then we expand on that and say the NFL live show, that makes money. That doesn't make zero money. That gets decent viewership for a weekday show. And there's plenty of revenue in that show. So there's a budget within that show, and there's a budget within ESPN in the whole for good NFL content, good NFL analysts. That's where Mina comes in. Mina at 2 million is not making what I think Joe Buck's around 15 million and Troy Aikman's around 20 million a year. Clearly not going to be making that much because those two guys have every, you know, they the market spoke and said that's what the top guys are worth in terms of analysts, and that's what and top and color analysts and play guys, and that's what happened. So that's a reason why Mina is making a lot, not making as much as those guys, but couldn't make that much at Spotify or The Ringer. And that leads us to Spotify. So, Wall Street Journal article from 2 weeks ago, I think now, title, Spotify's $1 billion podcast bet turns into a serial drama. And the thrust of the piece was that Spotify spent a lot of money on podcasting and they haven't gotten any benefit from it yet. So they're still losing money on podcasting. And the article went into some of the shows that they were producing, $75,000 to $250,000 an episode. That's insane. So clearly there's a big reason for that. And I think what the article really kind of got into is that there was this splurge of spending by Spotify. But they didn't really have a game plan as to how to monetize the spending. And so I've been talking on this podcast a lot about how I don't think the podcasting stable business works. I don't think buying up a bunch of podcasts works because when you buy a podcast, you're typically signing someone to a contract. So this is what they did with Rogan. I think Bill's on an employment contract with Spotify. So you're buying into a podcast for 4, 5, 6 years, whatever the contract is. But in order for the talent to agree to that, they have to be paid pretty similarly or more to what they could make on their own. So if Bill Simmons set up shop on his own, same thing with Joe Rogan. Like, why did Joe Rogan leave for Spotify? They probably offered him more money than he was making on his own. But then that begs the question of how is Spotify monetizing Joe Rogan's podcast? Same thing with Simmons. If Rogan is making was making $10 million a year in his podcast and Spotify is paying him $20 million a year, well, you got to make up the 10 million somewhere. And I think what Spotify wanted to do is they said, we're going to make that up because if we build this podcasting stable, we acquire all these great podcasts, we're going to force people into our ecosystem to listen to the podcast. We're going to make them exclusive. And then they're going to be forced to get a Spotify subscription. And that's either going to mean more revenue through us for subscription revenue or through advertising revenue. And what I think they underestimated is that there's no fucking way anybody could make a podcasting stable. People are making podcasts all the time. I mean, heck, I'm making this podcast right now. Not that I'm contributing to this, but it's not like Spotify is the only podcast creator. Anybody makes podcasts. So Spotify was never going to get all of the podcasts and get every single podcast listener to switch to Spotify. Now, when Spotify buys The Ringer, they originally wanted Bill Simmons to have his podcast exclusive to Spotify. And what would that have done? Well, it would have done two things. Yes, it would have drawn in people to Spotify for sure, but it also would have completely killed the listenership of the podcast because it wasn't available widely. So that would have hurt the advertising revenue big time, and that would have hurt Bill Simmons and Bill Simmons's brand. So Bill smartly axed that idea, and that's kind of been the reason ultimately why his podcast has, gained in popularity versus maybe a podcast like Rogan, who's exclusive to Spotify. That's going to happen. So ultimately, the business plan of Spotify failed. However, Bill Simmons keeps getting promoted there, right? He keeps getting these titles. I've always thought in this podcast, and that sounds like it's kind of name only, but it might not actually be now. Because in this article, Bill Simmons gets some love. Bill Simmons maybe gets the only positive mention in this article. And I'll read the quote here. It says, "The Ringer, a podcast studio led by Bill Simmons, has doubled the number of shows it produces to more than 50 since it was acquired by Spotify in 2020. The programs largely center on conversations instead of more costly, highly produced stories." So they're essentially giving him props by saying Bill Simmons is not the one that's doing a $250,000 podcast episodes. So if you're looking at the studio of The Ringer, you're looking at Spotify overall, The Ringer might be the most successful acquisition, honestly, because Bill and his team are producing a lot more shows. They're probably, leaving aside the price tag, The Ringer itself, their audio, I don't know about the website, but the audio Ringer is probably making money for Spotify. It might not be 10 million bucks, but it's something. And you compare that to Prince Meghan. You compare that to Prince Harry and Meghan. You compare that to the Obamas. You compare that to random celebrities that they get paid all this money, they get no content, and it's dreadful. They don't make any money on it. So Bill Simmons comes out looking pretty good here. And then I also wanted to talk about this. So this is from the article as well. Spotify recently agreed to pay comedian Trevor Noah $4 million in a deal that allows the company to collect revenue from the podcast to cover its investment. After that, both sides share the take. Spotify intends to pursue similar deals, and Spotify has started to share more of the risk with its talent. So this makes a lot more sense. So this is one of those deals where, okay, Trevor Noah is, quote, signing for $4 million, but he only gets a significant amount of money if his podcast does well, which makes pretty logical sense, right? So I think there's two ways to look at this from the perspective of Bill Simmons's expiring contract, from the perspective of Bill's going to re-up on Spotify. On one hand, when you hear a deal like that with Trevor Noah, you go, They're pursuing deals like that. In general, the podcast business is not doing that well. Spotify might look to re-up on a worse contract for Bill than he's on now. Maybe that means Bill Simmons goes out on his own, does his own thing. Now, conversely, you could also look at this article and say Bill Simmons is pretty much the only positive thing about Spotify podcasting right now. Why would Spotify let him go, especially as they're giving him increased responsibilities, head of podcast monetization innovation? They'll actually keep re-upping him and keep the whole Ringer audio team there going forward. That's a potential as well. Also, this would be a safe phasing mechanism for safe phasing. Face-saving mechanism for Spotify when they did the big Ringer deal. So those are the kind of opposing forces, and it's a tough one. I'm gonna say it's a really tough one to call now because I think this article has changed my view a little bit to say I think Bill Simmons' standing at Spotify is higher than I previously thought because he's actually doing with his team more of what Spotify has benefited from, as opposed to these huge celebrity contracts that are just absolutely jokes. And the fact that Simmons even felt okay to kind of publicly diss Prince Harry and Meghan is pretty interesting. So, all right, I think I'll end it there. Those are the big three things. If anybody has any questions on it, I could always answer this in a mailbag going forward. I do think we are going to do more episodes focused on the sports media angle. So, look, if you're interested in more of this, let us know. And then always, if you like the podcast, rate us 5 stars on Spotify and Apple. Leave us a 5-star review. We'll read those on the show. I'll read those on the show going forward. And remember to listen to episode 38 and 39 as well, because a lot of great content. So with that, cheers, have a great weekend, and until the next episode.